This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Our guest in this show is Richard Relis, who is a longtime Arizona Republic reporter. He has been doing a fascinating newspaper series and podcast series presenting new material relating to the Don Bowles story. Don Bowles, to give the short of it, if the name doesn't register with you, was an investigative reporter who was investigating organized crime in Phoenix in the early 1970s. In 1976, somebody had him killed, but it was kind of a statement killing. He wasn't just shot. He was blown up, which is kind of a mob type statement. You know, we want everybody to see this. Fascinating project. Interesting to me. I came to this town about 3 years after it happened, and you know, it was still ancient history then, and I've gotten it piece by piece on this after the fact. But it was fascinating. I would commend the podcast series to you. Fascinating to me, in addition that you had interviewed a whole lot of people that I knew. And notably, Pat McMahon, who worked for many years in this very studio, and who we will have a clip from later on. But let me start out welcoming you and ask you to sort of flesh out a little bit the basics of the story as people understood it before any of your work.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Good evening. Don Bowles became kind of shorthand for just this reporter who was blown up outside the Clarendon. And I think he became known for his death. I think the story we tried to tell with the podcast is more about how he lived and the work he did. And we were able to do that by finding a trove of material that I didn't expect to find when I was assigned about a year ago to go look at these locked file cabinets that we had brought back to the newsroom. They had been taken to a warehouse somewhere.
Where they sat for almost 40 years, I guess.
Well, I really don't know when they moved from our building. You know,
that's right. Probably the Republic, I forget, 20 or some odd years ago, moved a couple of blocks. That's probably when it ended up where
we were at 120 Van Buren, and we moved across the street to 200 East Van Buren, a brand new building. Somewhere along the way, these file cabinets that had been padlocked shut, you know, they put an iron bar across the drawer so that no one could open them, got taken to a warehouse, and somehow someone decided to bring them back.
Maybe forgot about them for years.
Well, you think you have like a storage unit that you have, and you think years later, why do we still have that storage unit? I wonder what's in there that was so valuable. And so that's kind of what the Arizona Republic did. And they went to the storage unit, looked at what was there. These file cabinets, padlocked shut, seemed intriguing. So they were brought back into the newsroom by our editor, Greg Burton, who was curious what was in them. We didn't know where the keys were, so we had to hire a locksmith. And looking in them, Greg Burton, our editor, quickly discerned these are related to the Bowles case. And he told me, get down there, see what's in them, and see if there's a story to be told or stories to be told that are in there. So I go down there, and again, the Bowles story, people sort of know the broad parameters of it. He's that reporter who was killed.
Was doing investigative work related to organized crime at some level. I think that's the level most people understand it. I'm not all that different from most, I think, in that regard.
Right. And so it was a challenge to think, is there something new in here? Obviously, his files have probably been gone through by other reporters, even by law enforcement. But I was looking to see if there was anything revelatory or new. And in the first pass through the drawers, I came across a manila envelope that was stuffed with cassette tapes. And I thought, at the very least, this is new. The paperwork has been gone through, but we at the newspaper, I mean, even when I started, there was no website. We produced a printed product that was delivered to your doorstep. Now we're being encouraged to tell stories with audio. So I thought, I'm going to listen to these cassettes. Maybe there's something there. And fairly quickly, I discovered there was a story there. And again, it's not necessarily the story of how the man died, but a story of what it was like for him to be a reporter in the 1970s in Phoenix, a much smaller city, and some of the struggles he went through in just trying to do his job, a job that he eventually would be killed for.
And both in the clips that you sent me and in the podcast, it was evident to me, among other things, technology has changed a lot, and a lot of these tapes were just downright awful and showed a huge disparity in the volume of the two people. You talked about how the recording over phone back then was made with an acoustic coupler that you shoved over the over one end of the phone.
Yeah, or there was just like a suction cup you would stick on. Yeah. And we're talking about an old school handheld receiver. You would stick a device to the side of it, and then that would get the vibrations and take it to a recorder. I remember using those when I started as a reporter in the early 90s. And if you stood if you sat too close to the phone, you would pick up a weird buzz. If you sat too far away, you know, it would get better. We had computers at the time. You couldn't sit too close to the computer. Obviously, in Bowles' day, there was no computer. It was a typewriter. And these tapes were in really bad shape. Who knows how many times they had been played and re-recorded over and over.
They probably weren't, given the analog technology, they probably weren't great to begin with. And then they're 40 years old and they're replayed over and over.
Right.
And there's a physical thing that wears out.
It's a physical thing that wears out. And they weren't preserved in any way. You know, they're not even in the cassette shells that you would put your recordings in. These were just loose. And so I just took them. There's no cassette player in the Republic newsroom.
You probably had to.
I actually had an old cassette portable player that in my desk, which I dug out, put some fresh batteries in, and it turned out that cassette player was broken.
So I had to. Because you hadn't used it.
I had to take these cassettes home to see if there's anything of value here. And so I grabbed the first tape at random and put it in. And yeah, I'm just hoping that A, there's sound coming out, and B, that it doesn't break, because I'm remembering my struggles growing up with cassettes.
And right? Having you tape it back together and hope that the mechanism will still turn.
They get caught in the wheel. You start hearing crunching sound. Yeah. You need to use a pencil to wind them tightly.
Yep, yep.
All those things. And I just know I probably have one shot at figuring out, you know, grabbing this digitally. I was able to hook up my cassette player to my computer. So I figured I had one shot to grab this digitally and then try to figure out what
so,
was
So you,
what was
so you played it the first time but made a digital copy as
made
you were
a
listening.
Digital copy, yeah. Mm-hmm. We couldn't have done this if it was playing the digitals. Or, I mean, I'm sorry. We couldn't have done this if we were just relying on the analog cassettes over and over. So I was grabbing digital copies. Of course, about two or three tapes in, one breaks. rewinding it at tape breaks, and I'm trying to Google and YouTube how to repair a cassette tape, and I realize I don't trust myself to crack open this cassette tape that could have something of value on it.
And all the technicians who knew how to do this are no longer around.
Luckily, and they haven't bought the time or anything, but there's a business in Tempe called On-Site Video. And apparently it's one of the few businesses in the country that still knows how to repair cassettes. So, because they say they get cassettes delivered to them from across the country. So they took on the task of repairing the cassettes. And then we eventually had them start digitizing them. And again, the task was to see, is there something of interest on these tapes? The first thing that was of interest was to hear the man's voice. And, you know, his picture is in our newsroom. I had never even thought that he had a voice. Yeah. I never thought what he sounded like. But on these tapes, I'm hearing a guy say, this is Don Bowles from the Arizona Republic. And that was the first big revelation.
And then you played it for his wife.
Yes. We, as part of this, you know, we not only wanted to look back at the tapes that Don Bowles had made, and see if there was a story to be told, but we wanted to talk to people still around who knew him. And Rosalie Bowles was his wife, his widow. We were able to go to Lancaster, South Carolina. Not only did we play some tapes for her, I gave her some CDs, so she has them for her family.
That's a nice ending. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll pick up the story. We've talked about what you did, and when we come back in the think tank, we'll talk about what you found in the think tank in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're talking to Arizona Republic reporter Richard Rellis, who has engaged in a fascinating, really, piece of historical work, rummaging through Don Bowles' old papers and tapes. And in the last segment, we talked about sort of how you went about it. Walk us through the story, if you would, a little bit. What kind of things was Don Bowles investigating, and tell us the story of that.
The Bowles came here and was sort of a favorite reporter of the publisher of the Republic, Eugene Pulliam, and he was put on all sorts of government corruption type stories. He looked at land fraud. He looked at dealings, you know, self dealings by government officials. He looked at mob influence, if the mob was infiltrating the state. But he also looked at the greyhound racing industry, which was owned by one family.
Yeah, you make a really interesting point about how big that was. That doesn't sound like a big deal now, but it really was.
Right. The Phoenix Greyhound Park, it was the only place you could legally gamble. So
no casinos, no state lottery, nothing. This is it.
And, you know, we were a smaller city then, but imagine that drive that gets people to go out to the tribal casinos, mm-hmm. all of that compressed.
Into one place.
Into one place. It still stands on Washington. Mm-hmm. A night at the dog track was an option for a good night mm-hmm. out in Phoenix.
So now Bowles mainly known, I think, for park and swap is about the only thing I see going on there.
Right. Now it's a swap meet. Mm-hmm. We did walk around the grounds. It is the money that the Greyhound Park made, the building that hasn't been used in a decade, is so well preserved. Hmm. It was so well constructed. But Bowles was assigned to look at the greyhound racing industry, and he found mob influence, mob ties in a company that sort of Emprise, that was sort of a shadow co-owner of the tracks. And he started writing about it. And he started writing about how the Racing Commission wasn't doing the job they should do overseeing this. The story we found on the tapes, and it was where Bowles got really emotional, is he discovers that the Funk family has hired someone to investigate him, to dig up dirt on him. And the person that tells him this alleges that the Funk family had someone wiretap his home telephone and had someone get his bank account information. And as a reporter...
And that was, he was told that by the guy who was hired to do it.
Yeah, the guy who was hired to do it told that there's some vast conspiracy that the Republic and a congressman at the time, Sam Steiger, were in league to close down the Greyhound Park. They wanted them out of business. So go investigate this guy. He's dirty. He's probably has mob money behind him. He's probably being paid to write these stories. We want you to go through his phone records, listen to his home phone if you can. At least that's his story. If you get to his bank account, you'll probably find payments from Vegas interests. And you're going to prove this conspiracy for us. The guy who does the investigation realizes shortly after some time, there's no conspiracy. This is just a guy trying to do his job. And he turns his back on his friends on the racetracks and tells Don Bowles and the congressman, Sam Steiger, what he's been up to. So this enrages Don Bowles. And it's a story that I guess I had sort of bounced around in my periphery, that Don Bowles alleged he had been wiretapped. Mm-hmm. But listening to the tapes, it seemed to be a story that really deeply affected Bowles as a reporter.
Your privacy's been invaded.
Yeah. The subjects of his story are coming after him. And they're coming after him through his home and going after him and his wife. And it seemed like... Just from the emotion Don Bowles has on the tapes when he's talking about this, it seemed like this is a tale. This is a story that we can tell that's not necessarily about how he died.
It's about who he was and what was going on.
It's about who he was, although it does dovetail. I mean, when your lead character is going to get blown up outside a hotel on his way to a reporting assignment, that's going to be part of any story you tell about this man.
Of course.
But it does seem, from what we were able to discern, this story that was forgotten seemingly by everyone else, the story of wiretapping was still on Don Bowles' mind the morning, that summer in June 76 that he was blown up.
Which was really a couple years later than most of this.
Yeah. This story was wrapped up by 1973. Mm-hmm. You know, there were back and forth lawsuits, and Bowles was sort of taken off the racing beat.
One real quick question. We got maybe 30 seconds on this. The guy who turned and told this story, from the podcast, I wasn't entirely sure if you believed his story about how he just saw the light. Do you?
It certainly seemed there's nothing that knocks down his story. It's just that the authorities who looked into it, federal and county, mm-hmm. could never get enough to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. They couldn't bring his story before a grand jury or before a prosecutor. So it just kind of laid there. And I think the fact no one ever got retribution, no one was punished for wiretapping into a reporter's home mm-hmm. phone, that's really what stuck into Don Bowles' craw. Mm-hmm. He wanted the public to know about this. He wanted revenge.
Okay, we'll pick up the story with Richard Rellis and the story of Don Bowles, A New Perspective, when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The streets that lead them and sirens call them on with a song.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're talking with Richard Rellis of the Arizona Republic, and we are talking about his recent project investigating, based on new information, the whole story of Don Bowles. In the preceding section, we talked about the reason why Bowles, or how he reacted to the notion that he was being tapped and investigated. And another kind of read between the lines, it wasn't very subtle in your podcast, was the suggestion that, you know, a reporter gets blown up, it's easy for them to be canonized and that they're only of good motivation. But my read between the lines, not very deep between the lines, was that he may have had a bit of zealotry in his approach to things. Way I kind of wondered about it. It's sort of a guy who can find, you know, 9 out of the last 7 conspiracies.
Well, it certainly seemed, listening to how he did his work, you did not want to be the subject of one of Don Bowles' stories. Mm-hmm. He was someone who would not be shaken if he was convinced you were a bad actor. Mm-hmm. Not a bad actor, meaning, you know, on the stage and screen, but a bad person doing things that were bad. He was going to be unrelenting in getting you, and it would take a lot to move him off of that. It would take a lot, if it was possible at all, to move him off of believing you were bad. He seemed, and there were reporters who worked with him who said it was almost to a fault, that he would get locked in. This person is doing this bad thing, and I
got to find it.
I'm going to find it. And any little detail is going to just add to the pile. Mm-hmm. There are no coincidences. There's nothing that can be explained or rationalized. Everything serves the purpose of proving this is bad. And among the people who were unhappy with him were the folks who ran the Greyhound Racing Park, the Phoenix Greyhound Park, owned by the Funk family. They just felt they could not get a fair shake from Don Bowles. And so part of their reasoning for wanting to investigate Don Bowles, to get him, to kind of smear him if they believed there was dirt to be had on Bowles, was to just get him out of their hair, to move him onto something else, to discredit him. In a way, they sort of succeeded of moving him off the racing beat.
Because he was pretty much by the middle 70s, well in advance of the time he was killed, he was pretty much off of that beat, wasn't he?
Right. There had been back and forth lawsuits, including...
He was sued for $20 million or something.
He was sued for $20 million. The newspaper was sued for $20 million. It seemed, by the way, looking at old clips of the time, the Republic was sued a lot more often back then than they are now, for whatever reason. But this battle seemed to take a lot out of him. His drive to make these people pay seemed to take a lot out of him. And eventually it all settled. The paper settled, and whether it was part of the settlement or not is not clear, but Bulls stopped covering racing. Mm-hmm. So the Funks were able to succeed in getting Bulls off the off their backs, off the Greyhound racing beat. And Bulls was sent to cover the state legislature. He was not assigned to do the types of investigative reporting he had been doing. And I think the paper tried to still placate him or make him still seem like he was a major player in the state. You know, they ran full-page ads in the late 60s and early 70s announcing, you know, Don Bowles' latest investigative work. They also took an ad out, a House ad, that kind of touted that he was going to be covering the legislature and try to make a big deal out of that. But people who worked with him at the time said it was much more routine, pedantic work, and that his heart wasn't in it as much. And it seemed to be a bit both. He wished he could be doing the kind of stories he was doing before, but as one of his friends, the former columnist Paul Dean, told me, it also was that he put so much of himself into these stories and the public didn't respond. The major changes he was expecting never really happened. And the thought was, well, if the public doesn't care, why should I? Mm-hmm.
I also get the sense that the lawsuits from your work, I get the sense that the lawsuits may have broken him too. They were scary sums of a guy who we know from public records didn't have much of anything.
Right. I mean, in one of the lawsuits, they ask him about his assets, essentially warning him, with this lawsuit, this countersuit you filed, if the judge finds it frivolous or we find it frivolous, we're going to ask that you have to pay our fees as attorneys.
Which he won't be able to do.
And it's going to be very expensive, they tell him. And they ask him about how much equity he has in his house. They ask him about his cars. He mentions he drives a Plymouth with a bad wobble in the front. They ask him about how much he socked away for his kids' college education. And they sort of let him know you're going to be financially ruined by this. And I think his motivation in filing the lawsuit was to prove a point. And that point was, I was wronged. And these were the people who wronged me. And I want everyone to see that. If the federal authorities and the county authorities were not going to punish the racetrack owners for wiretapping or bugging my home phone, I'm going to make them pay using this lawsuit. It just didn't work out the way he hoped. And I think this story gnawed at him in all the years after. I mean, there was a parlor game my editor had as we were talking about this story. He said, you know, what stories would be on your mind all these years later? You know, there's some mm-hmm. stories that you just don't let go of. Mm-hmm. And there's still court records I check on or check to see what so-and-so is up to. There are stories that just gnaw at you as a reporter that you just can't put in the background. And for him, this was one of them. And that's why I think it extended out. You know, much was made of the words he said after the bombing. He said the name John Adamson, who was the man who lured him to the Hotel Clarendon. He said Emprise and
the
Mafia.
The company, yeah.
Yeah, and Mafia and Emprise to him were one and the same. Mm-hmm. Emprise was part of the Mafia. Emprise was the company that controlled the racetracks. And to me, it says that he was still thinking, Emprise.
What do you think about the gist of what he was claiming, that there were mob influences on racing and that racing in the state was corrupt?
It seemed like Emprise had done business with mob-connected figures. Now, whether that means they were mob-controlled is a matter of debate. Mm-hmm. And again, we're dealing with a reporter who taken that nugget of information that they had done business with mob-controlled entities is enough for him to make the leap. Mm-hmm. They're mob-owned, and so are the Funks, and the Phoenix Greyhound mm-hmm. Park is a mob entity. He was able to paint it with a broad brush. It's hard to know whether Bowles was correct necessarily in his assertion. It's a accurate presumption. One could make that claim, as he did. But whether they were as bad as, say, you know, whether they were truly a mob-controlled entity
okay.
is different than being around
mobbies.
You're
saying there's, I think, some open questions.
There are some open questions.
I'll leave it at that. One thing I do want to ask about. After the bombing, there was a group came in, including some personal friends and colleagues came in, called themselves investigative reporters. And the Phoenix was descended upon by reporters from all over the country.
Yes.
They said basically, in effect, you're blowing up one of ours. The story is not going to end. We're going to come in here and we're going to take this thing wherever it goes. They did a report. They did a lot of reporting. The Republic, as I recall, refused at least initially to print the results of the work.
They didn't print any of it.
Yeah. Why?
I always heard growing up here and working at the paper that the Republic was just too afraid to run it. Looking at it deeper, the Republic wasn't the only entity that didn't run it. The New York Times didn't run it. The LA Times didn't run it. The Chicago Tribune didn't run it. Ben Bradley, the editor of the Post, made fun of it. Said we expected this thing was going to blow the lid off the city, and he called it soft as cake. The lead mentioned how pretty the sunsets were in Arizona. Mm. Like, everyone expected this major series, and a lot of these editors said it undersold itself. The Republic also said that much of the work that was in the report had been in the paper before, mm-hmm. some of it done by Don Bowles, that looked at mob influence, that looked at mm-hmm. corruption.
I think about that and I think, you know, okay, so maybe it isn't page one above the fold, but to this very large group of reporters came in here and this is what they found. Whatever it is, seems to me that's newsworthy in and of itself.
Yeah, and
even if it's not much.
Yeah, and we talked to some folks involved, including George Weiss, who was involved in the project, and happened also.
He was a state investigator.
He worked mm-hmm. in the retrial of some of the men accused. Mm-hmm. But he said, yeah, that they were baffled. The Republic had lent people, reporters, editors, writers, to help put it together, mm-hmm. and then decided at the last minute not to run it.
So, what's your take? Why?
Having read it, I can see why the paper held off. Mm-hmm. It was delivered to papers late, apparently, mm-hmm. to make the decision to run that weekend. And I could see the paper finding reasons not to run it, joining in the company of larger reporters or larger newspapers. But I could also see it, that being an excuse, because it went after people like Barry Goldwater, mm-hmm. that maybe it was a good excuse for them to say, this gets after too many people. Let's put it aside.
We'll be back in a concluding segment. Play some of the tape recordings that you found, a few of them that were of better quality. And a lot of them weren't. But we'll be back with a concluding section with some personal observations, including one interesting story involving KTAR's own Pat McMahon when we return for final segment. With Richard Bareilles here, talking Don Bowles.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back here with Richard Bareilles of the Arizona Republic. He's done some fascinating archival and really historical research on the Don Bowles case, and having had access to not only his files, but also to some tape recordings. And I'll let you introduce a couple of these that you found that really had kind of eerie overtones.
Well, this first one was one that I started playing with to my editors and said, there's a story not only to be told here about what Bowles went through, but this one showed how much on his mind how much danger he thought he was in. And in retrospect, it is very chilling. This is Bowles talking to a Democratic Party official named Paul Rademacher, who's describing seeing Don Bowles outside the Republic building one day.
One day I drove by the newspaper. You had your car parked across the street on 2nd Street.
Mm-hmm.
And you were looking at your tires and looking around your car.
Mm.
And just the way you're looking at it, you know, I had been in there sometime before that. I knew you were spooked.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew something was going on. That's when I got to you. You know, I...
Well, as a matter of routine, I always check to see if anybody's been fiddling with it because, you know, I know what I'm up against.
Yeah, so that was 1970, and telling us...
Yeah, and he wasn't killed till 76, so...
Right, so 6 years before the bombing, he's telling us he looked under his car as a matter of routine back then because as he says, I knew what I was up against. He's reporting about the mob. He's reporting about these powerful entities. He thinks someone may get him, and that could be the way they get him.
Wow. Yeah. And the other... the other tape we pulled out here has even eerier.
And, you know, he taped a lot of conversations. Some of them were, you know, people that he was doing stories on. But he just kept the tape rolling, it seemed, for random conversations, sometimes with readers who would call in. So, and again, just given the perspective, as I was looking at the tapes, as I was logging them, I could see, boy, we're hit 72, 73, 1975. You know, I'm measuring how long this guy has left.
This is like a movie where you already know the ending.
Right. And I started listening to these tapes inside the middle of the movie, having no idea what was going on and having to piece it together. But here's Bowles in, I believe this is also 1970, talking to a guy whose business is cemeteries. And telling Bowles he could get him his death wholesale if he wished.
Monuments and cemeteries is my business. You want to die, I'll get it to you wholesale.
No, sir. I don't care to right now. I'm only 42, and I think I'll stick around a while.
Yeah, so it's the kind of joke that one might make in their normal life and not think a second time about. But again, given this character... given how he was going to have his life end, it is chilling to hear how he, you know, these things that probably just rolled off his back take on new perspective now knowing how he met his demise.
It's certainly, were it not for the way he died, it's an unremarkable conversation that we've probably all had at some point or another, just in jest.
Yeah, and it's one, you know, that little revelation that from the first clip, that he would check under his car. His widow didn't know that until later, that he would check under his car. And she admitted, you know, some of that made her angry. He checked under his car every time.
And but didn't by tell 1970s, her. Didn't and hid that from her.
He hid that from her. And by 1976, he stopped being on guard. Yeah. He let his guard down.
Well, he wasn't on that beat anymore. He thought, I've moved on.
Yeah. Yeah, but I found a lot of new stories. And, you know, you're going to play the Pat McMahon clip. I have talked to Pat McMahon for dozens of hours. You know, I did a couple Wallace and Ladmo book projects with him. And he knew I worked at the paper, and we talked loosely about Don Bowles through the years. I had never heard his personal connection to Don Bowles until we interviewed him for this project. He and Don Bowles, Wallace and Pat McMahon, would write... Wallace of the Wallace and Ladmo show, they would help Don Bowles write skits for the Arizona Press Club Folly Review. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Don Bowles would pitch them skits that were awful, and Wallace and McMahon would fix them and make them better. So McMahon knew him.
Let's play the Pat McMahon clip. I think you'll recognize the voice here.
In May 1976, just weeks before Bowles' death, there was a roast of the noted humor columnist Irma Bombeck. She was nationally known, appeared on Good Morning America, best-selling author, and she lived in Paradise Valley. Arizona Republic reporter Don Bowles was at the roast. So was Pat McMahon, who was a well-known radio and TV personality. McMahon went up to Bowles and made one of those cracks one might make at a function like this.
I said, Don, I'm really glad that you came over and that I could talk to you for just a moment to try my best to pound some kind of sense into that head of yours, because you keep picking on all of these lovely business people. Why is it you pick on these folks, you know, instead of just simply writing nice things about some of the nice people? You could say sweet things about them, Don. His answer stayed with me to this day. Because he looked at me and he didn't laugh this time. He said, "Funny that you should mention that, Pat, because this is my last story about those people." He said, "I promised my wife that I was going to wrap that part of my career up." And I said something like, "No offense, Don, but what else can you do?" And I didn't mean to make it sound as if you were limited. "And I don't think you're going to go into the," and I said this, "into the obits."
Yeah, you know, this ended up, we didn't intend to make it a story about how the man died, but how he lived. But again, his death looms large. And I hope that one of the results is that it brings new insight into this man, into the kind of work he did, the kind of work journalists are still trying to do around the country. But that it's a new way of humanizing this person who's become sort of just a name and an incident, that it really brings people a sense of the humanity behind this name.
Yeah, and I think especially poignant in an era where we're hearing from some voices that reporters are the enemy.
There is that Don Bowles definitely, for all the zealousness and the doggedness, he was someone who went after facts. He was someone who went after what he saw as corruption and wasn't going to let go.
And he was ultimately a man doing his job. Thank you, Richard Bareilles. Fascinating insight. I commend the podcast, which you can get wherever you download podcasts from. And write-ups in the newspaper as well, which you should all subscribe to. We'll see you next week with another story in the Think Tank. Thank you, Richard. And sirens call them on.